So we just recorded like an hour-long conversation about nukes. So I'm really happy to come down by doing cultural war.
Yeah, petty literary magazine journal drama is exactly what you probably need.
But it did strike me like as I was kind of watching all of the fallout from it. Jason, if you had a chance to read, did you read the piece? Okay. Well, let's back way up. This will be a weird one, and it's kind of like on a topic that no matter how we cover or who we talk to, we always get angry emails about. Like every single time.
Awesome.
Can you introduce yourself?
Sure thing. My name is Matt Gallagher. I'm a author and novelist and journalist. Many years ago, I spent 15 months in Iraq with the U.S. Army, which is kind of how I got my start as a writer. I've written about a bunch of different things since, sometimes conflict related, sometimes veteran issues related, sometimes through hiking or big buck hunter. And I most recently have gone to Ukraine a few times, both as a volunteer and a journalist. And I have a new novel out, kind of loosely informed from those experiences, called Daybreak. It's like, it's a war story, but it's also kind of more about, I don't know, everyday people trying to do the best they can in the midst of a terrible armed invasion.
When you say as a volunteer, what did that entail?
So late February 2022, I joined a small group of fellow military veterans that I know in my travels. Who they went over to Lviv in the west of the country. One of them, my friend Adrian Bonnenberger, was going with his Ukrainian wife to kind of help evacuate their in-laws who are elderly and weren't going to leave on their own volition. Benjamin Bush also joined us, and while we were in Lviv, kind of under the loose authority of the local city council, we trained kind of everyday civilians, bus drivers, teachers, welders, who just kind of wanted to learn basic self-defense stuff. You know, most of these people hadn't even held a gun before, but at the time, you know, the invasion didn't reach that far. At the time, there was certainly the threat of it doing so, and these were people who, you know, weren't going to join the military probably, but wanted to. If it came to it, if they needed to defend their house, their neighborhood, wanted to at least have some kind of basic self-defense training, so they just didn't kind of run out into the street and get slaughtered needlessly. So it was real basic stuff, but it was real, real fulfilling, honest work. We were there for about 3 weeks doing that.
Why did you go?
It's a great question. Because I only had, when Adrian called and said this was happening, I think we had about, he's like, well, we're meeting at JFK in 48 hours. So I think it just kind of seemed like a very unique opportunity. You know, there was a plan, there was a coherent plan through his wife and his in-laws. You know, it wasn't just kind of showing up and being like, here, I'm an American, I'm here to help. It was like a very specific thing. You know, even kind of my very modest experience in Iraq was something they needed. Ben, the third trainer, is a retired lieutenant colonel, so you know, he was going to be heading the operation. They just kind of needed somebody with base level knowledge, and I don't know if I would ever forgive myself for not going because of all that, because it was thought out and I was needed. And you know, I'd been many years since I'd kind of actually gone and done something and worked with my hands. I've been a writer for over a decade now, talking about ideals and talking about the difference between just wars and unjust co wars and unjust causes. And here was a cause that you know, and still I believed in and still believe in the Ukraine's right to self-determination. Here was a small but direct way I could help. You know, the least I could do is convince my wife of its worthwhileness and actually just go show up.
How did that conversation go?
She has not forgotten it. How about that? You know, anytime there's a minor dispute in the house, it gets brought up. But she was actually very cool about it. I mean, I had to make the case. It was, you know, it was a conversation. It was a long conversation. She's not the type to just let me go on adventures just because. But she heard me out to her credit, and now I have to do the dishes for the next 4 decades. So.
I like doing the dishes.
You can, you know, you can, if you get into that zone where you're kind of meditating, yeah, it's not so bad.
Yeah, exactly. That way I don't have to do the laundry. That's our division of labor.
I like doing the laundry
smart,
too.
Smart man.
There's something like orderly and prescribed about both of those activities. Like as far as household chores go, like I like vacuuming. I don't know.
Matthew, you're going to have to come and stay here for a while.
What's sad is if the pay were decent, I could clean house. I'd be fine with that. Just like put on the radio, zone out, do some vacuuming. And then like you've got this very narrow goal and it's accomplished at the end of it. The problem is that we don't, you know.
Just like Ukraine.
All right, exactly fine. Like Ukraine. Fine. Bring me back into it. Don't want to talk about household chores. I get it. It's fine. So how then does that experience become a novel?
So I went back. That was February and March of 2022. And I went back as a journalist in the first time October 2022, and then again in August 2023. And on each trip, I became kind of keenly aware that I was meeting people, having conversations, hearing anecdotes, second or third hand, that I couldn't necessarily source, right? That wouldn't make it past the fact checker. But were real compelling, were real messy and complicated. Even that first trip, the bus ride in from Poland, we kind of came in with like the first wave of international legionnaires who were answering Zelensky's call, right, to show up and fight. And even then, even on that bus, you could tell some were legit and some were just kind of weirdos with not much else going on. And it was real interesting, just kind of that mix and the mix of like, going and doing something like that on a whim's notice is, it's very brave, like to go fight for an ideal, for a cause in a country you probably haven't even been to before. It's also really strange. It's not a normal person decision. It's not a normal person thing to be able to take off from your regular life at the drop of a hat because some foreign president asked you to. And I was really, I wasn't sure. I didn't go to Ukraine that first time to write about it, but I am a writer, and you both know this. Like, it's how you interact with the world. It's how you process things, even when you're not consciously writing. You're taking notes. So I was really just kind of struck by that dissonance of here's this real big noble ideal, and some kind of flawed, lost souls, some flawed, disillusioned people. Pretty much every Western vet that I've met over there in each of my trips eventually brings up Iraq or Afghanistan or Syria and their feelings of disillusionment towards that. And they run the political spectrum. I've met communists, anarchists, kind of old school Republican types, regular liberals. But it's interesting. They all bring it up. And it's, of course it's a self-selected group because they're there. I get that. But it's that dissonance kind of really fascinates me. And as a writer, with my previous stuff, I've always, I like exploring kind of the messy grays of human existence. And this was that for sure. Some of the journalism stories we've seen about these international legionnaire types in the years since, some are better than others, of course, but they're kind of revealing some real interesting characters. And fictionalizing that and dramatizing it with a love story with a Ukrainian woman for at least one of the main characters. I don't know. It came together, frankly, in a way that my previous novels had not. And I don't know why. Maybe it's because of the war still ongoing and there's a sense of urgency, but this one, it really just tumbled out of me.
Tell me about some of the odd characters. And I'm also wondering, like you said, they bring up Iraq or Afghanistan. Like, as in that they were there or that they felt that those wars were unjust? Like, how are they bringing it up?
They, for at least the ones who, I'm not asking these people for their DD-214, but you can kind of quickly, when people are being honest about their experience, it takes about 20 or 30 minutes to kind of figure out if you're dealing with a bullshitter or at least somebody who's mostly telling the truth, right? I mean, you guys have done this in your own travels. And at least for the ones that kind of passed at least my legitimacy test for whatever it's worth, there was just kind of a sense of waste of both, you know, whether they're talking about their lost friends who were killed in those wars, or, you know, how much money and energy and military everything that we expended in those countries, that like the you know, and most of them were in their 30s or 40s, not all. There were a couple Syria vets in their 20s. But most of them kind of talked about wanting to join because of 9/11 and a sense of idealism that had since been betrayed based off, you know, whatever happened, you know, and there was a multitude of different reasons why. And they felt like this was the just cause that they'd been cheated out of. And the good ones, the smart ones, then talked about, well, I can provide a very specific purpose to the Ukrainian military or the Ukrainian people, right? I'm a medic. I can do this. I run a humanitarian organization. I can do this. Some of the more lost soul types, that they viewed it through kind of a prism of personal absolution, which, you know, you maybe can kind of understand if you want to be empathetic, but like, that's not really what a country at war needs, right? They don't need people bumbling around looking for ways to help. So, you know, I took kind of all these composite sketches of different people in different conversations, and I put them into two different American characters, one of whom is kind of a violent soldier who just wants to fight. And it turns out he's exactly what the Ukrainian recruiters want. And then the other one, the main character, Luke Paxton, he's probably a better person than his colleague, but he doesn't really know why he's there other than to try to find this woman. And that's most of the novel kind of follows his trajectory through Ukraine and through those opening weeks of the war.
Well, this sentence in the first paragraph, the end of the first paragraph of the novel, really struck me. Speaking to like why Pax is there, more than anything, Pax felt like someone again. That kind of cuts to the heart of it, right?
I think so. You know, it's cited a lot. It's even going over, you know, I served in Iraq and I decided it was not just war and wish it had never happened, but it was also the formative experience of my life, right? And I think a lot of veterans of my generation feel this way. And, you know, there's a very physical reaction to war, right? Like it's not just mental. Your body is actually primed and gets juiced up. It's like a survival mechanism. It's part of the reason, so many, you know, a lot of folks have trouble coming down from it and it's connected to their post-traumatic stress. And there is kind of a siren call to it, right? Like being intellectually aware that this is a terrible thing that's going to kill innocent people, kill good people, kill brave and honorable people. There's a reason, you know, humanity continues to pursue this, both for political reasons, right? Certainly on the macro level, right? You know, Russia's invading to conquer land and reclaim what they believe to be theirs. Ukrainian people disagree, but there's a siren call to it. And what Pax is feeling in that moment is that physical sensation. You know, he's a AutoZone mechanic here in the States before he takes off. His life, he feels is rudderless, is without purpose. And even though he had a very negative experience in Afghanistan 10 years prior, this feels somewhat right to him on a very visceral level. And that's fucked up, but it's interesting. And I hope readers agree.
And that's kind of, that feeling of rudderlessness is, I would say, part of the American vet experience right now, right? You come home from these wars. I mean, and I'm speaking now of experience with very close friends. And it takes a while, if they ever get there at all, to kind of figure out how to navigate civilian life, right?
Absolutely right. You know, some of them have chosen to go to Ukraine to deal with this. Others stormed the Capitol. Not to draw too direct of a parallel, but you know, there's a sense of what if. There's a sense of betrayal that I think permeates a lot of veterans. there's a sense of, I don't know, disillusionment is a word I just keep coming back to. You know, I wish more of my fellow vets of my generation were like this great retired Sergeant First Class I know who teaches high school honors history and is found like and is excellent at it. He's in Florida and his kids love him. And you know he's perfect. I can see him. He's perfect for that classroom and educating the next generation. I wish more were able to find a renewed sense of purpose the way he has, but that has not been the case. You know, I kind of made light of January 6th there, but there was an outsized representation of veterans there. They deserve what's happening to them now. I totally disagree with them politically. But I'd be lying if I said part of me doesn't recognize the kind of anger toward their country they're expressing. It's not a healthy way to express it, but it didn't come out of nowhere. It didn't, you know, 20 years of rudderless wars ending the way they did. Of course, there's going to be unforeseen consequences, not just to the people that went and served themselves, but on American society as a whole. I was talking about, you know, kind of another one is I was talking about this with a friend. It's kind of like a reflexive, and again, I'm generalizing, but like, you know, there's a very reflexive old school anti-war strain in kind of Generation Z. I personally don't agree with it. I wish there was kind of more room for, I consider myself anti-war, but there's just causes worth fighting for. At the same time, these kids grew up during the GWAT era. Like this is, of course, it makes all the sense in the world that a 28-year-old with all the fire and brimstone that a politically engaged 28-year-old is going to have, this is how they've landed on this subject.
When was the last time they saw America fight a just war and fight it well, right? I guess, I say that, and then there is Islamic State, right? We did fight that one, and that was a just war.
Yes, absolutely. I'd agree with that. I don't know how much it penetrated for whatever reason, like the American consciousness, you know, maybe that was part of it because we were advising and, you know, most of the heavy fighting was done by the Iraqis.
And the Kurds.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, how much of that because of the Iraq war that preceded taking back that land had already kind of been settled in terms of the public consciousness, I don't know. But I, you know, I do know when I talk to people in their 20s, they're zealots about this. And like, I don't recognize it. You know, I'm quickly accused of being a wishy-washy millennial, but you know, they came up in a different ecosystem than I did.
I would also just say they have different threats and a different sense of threat. You know, I mean, a lot of millennials will remember September 11th pretty clearly, however old they were. But I mean, it's horrible to think about, but there are kids who don't remember September 11th at all who can not just vote, but you know, oh my, I don't want to think about it, but you know what I mean.
But at the same time, they live with the ever present threat and probably daily reminder, thanks to SROs and kind of depending on where they live in the country, that an anonymous gunman is going to enter their school and kill all of them. And I don't want to discount that. And like, I was there for the very beginning of that fear in my high school. And I remember what that was like. So I think like a sense of threat, but also different threats is very important to keep in mind. Mm. And it's hard to care about, it's hard to imagine why you would go to war, I think, across the ocean when your government and your country can't keep you safe in your classroom.
Yeah. No, that's a strong point. And they feel that it's a sophisticated thing to do is to discount any kind of talking point coming from government, right? That well, of course, it has to be false. And you know, why should we be sending billions of dollars there when we can't deal with drug addicts on the street and homelessness here in the States? I get it. I find it unfortunate that you know, because there are historical examples, not as recent as Iraq or Afghanistan, but there are historical examples of America needing to go abroad to fight for righteous ideals, and in a way making sure these wars don't impact us more directly. You know, I had a conversation with my old platoon sergeant a couple of weeks ago who disagrees with me very much on Ukraine. And he said, well, you know, my son's 18. I don't want him being sucked into another forever war. And, you know, I tried to make the case, and he heard me out. I don't know if I changed his opinion or anything, but I said, you know, I made the case, like, right now we have a society willing to fight for the entire West. We just need to arm them, right? Like, if you don't want your kid getting drafted into World War III, the further we keep the Russian military away from the Baltic states and Poland, the better. And if you don't think Putin's not interested in that territory, just watch Tucker Carlson. Like, it's not a coincidence he mentioned Poland 40 times with Tucker Carlson.
Begging anyone to literally listen to anything Putin says publicly.
Just, yes, take him at his word, please.
Right, We're not advising people watch Tucker Carlson.
I did in this, you know, it was me being a generous generous citizen, reaching across the aisle, showing.
Well, consider him direct competition.
Okay.
Direct. Okay.
When you all get your sit down with Vladimir, I will send them your way.
Thank you.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that kind of brings, I think, like, remembering the empathy that you showed when talking about January 6th. And just kind of the empathy in this conversation generally brings me to the main topic that I saw you tweeting about, I'm sorry, and wanted to bring you on to talk about, which is, as you said, small-scale literary drama that has bubbled up into the wider world. Okay, I don't even know where to begin with this. Okay, tell me, is it, I'm going to pronounce this wrong because I'm terrible, Guernica?
Mm-hmm. No, you got it.
Okay. What was this literary magazine? Because it certainly seems like it may not survive this.
I don't think it's long for the world now. No, it's been around since, I believe, 2004. It's New York based. It's small. I wouldn't say many people outside of kind of literary circles know about it. It is more political than your average literary magazine. But it's a literary magazine with a political bent, might be the best way to put it. It's always been very overtly political, very overtly leftist, not even liberal, but like leftist. And, you know, kind of related to what we were talking about earlier, you know, most like any literary journal, it's mostly staffed by 20 and 30 somethings, right? Who maybe don't have much experience conversing with people from broader background. I mean, these are very, very smart, talented writers, but a lot of people in these bubbles are very kind of dogged ideologues. You know, I think since 2020, like most of the world, at least most of the country, people have kind of hardened even more so, right? And this is not a place that even when I was a younger writer, I think I probably submitted there a couple times, and I just kind of realized very quickly it was just not a place that was interested in a perspective of a white American military veteran. And that's fine. That's fine. Every, you know, it has its place. It has its purpose. It's doing its thing, whatever. They have been publishing some really interesting work pretty consistently by various Palestinian poets and writers. And then this blow up started probably about a week and a half ago when it published a personal essay by a woman named Joanna Chen, who is an Israeli writer and translator, originally from Britain, but she's lived in Israel now for a few decades. This is a woman that refused to join the IDF for political reasons and volunteers for an organization over there that brings injured Palestinian children to Israeli hospitals. I personally found the essay very anodyne. It's a fine essay. It's a personal essay, so it's a little self-indulgent, but that's the style of it. She's a good writer. She's talking about personal experiences and personal conversations she's had with friends from an Israeli perspective. There was a huge outcry pretty immediately by fellow Guernica contributors and some of the editors who objected to all kinds of things. There, you know, you can go on Twitter and find some of these resignation statements. Some of them are more coherent than others. Some are deeply baked in kind of that hard leftist academic jargon that can be hard to sift through.
10 editors but resigned, I believe, afterwards, right?
It snowballed. So it was like one after the other. There was kind of a real momentum. So at this point, one of the co-publishers ended up resigning. The entire fiction staff ended up quitting. And loosely, each one kind of attacked in a different way. But the idea was, how dare we be publishing a colonist's perspective? Others accused the essay of kind of whitewashing Palestinian genocide. I did not see any of this in the essay myself, but I'm just one reader. I have my own very specific perspective. They were very light on specifics of what was wrong with the essay, and it seems clear that more than anything, it was objecting to this perspective being published in Guernica. Right, that this was a safe space for a certain line of thought, a certain perspective on this war, and that this woman's writing maybe had a place, but it wasn't here. Well, that's all really kind of small potatoes. But the internet being the internet, I mean, this lady was really getting dogpiled on. And then some responses, probably most forcefully by Phil Cly in The Atlantic. Phil's a friend of mine, making the case that I believe he called it a betrayal of literature itself, right? That this was an act of cowardice, that if you can't handle this woman's perspective about war, that there's far more shocking opinions out there about it, there's all kinds of free speech and historical publication issues at play here. But if you're a serious writer, not that you should necessarily agree with this essay or even like this essay, but getting it actually canceled because the editor, Guernica, ended up withdrawing the essay, even though it seemed to make little to no impact in terms of the resignations. Getting this essay canceled really benefits no one. And you can still find the essay. I think it's Pieces of a Broken World by Joanna Chen is web archived. So it doesn't take too much digging to still find.
From the Edges of a Broken World.
Thank you.
I will put the Wayback link in the show notes so everyone can read it for themselves.
The last thing I just kind of wanted to touch on was, one of the fascinating things is from all this, here's a woman, however flawed or limited her essay may have been, who has been directly helping Palestinians in a way that I'm very certain none of these resigning poetry editors ever have. If this magazine goes belly up and it seems to be trending that way, well, here's a place that has been publishing a number of Palestinian voices from Gaza, right? This was one essay. They published at least 10 to 15 Palestinian authors and poets over the last few months. So all you've really done is ensure that those authors and voices have a harder time finding an English speaking audience, that they want to pay attention to what's happening to them. So as somebody that kind of exists on the periphery of this world, but because of my subject or just my background or whatever, like tries to think of these things through a pragmatic lens too, I find the whole thing just it mostly performative outrage. I do think that some people were very, Palestinian Americans in particular, this is a traumatic personal thing for them. I get that. I get being angry. I'm not asking you to get for them to get over their anger, but I am saying that in a free, open society, you kind of have to deal with it. And then I think you have that group of folks who objected to it, and then most people it was just performative outrage. It was just a way to kind of get online belly rubs, not anticipating the blowback that was going to occur from a much larger magazine and a much larger platform like The Atlantic.
You called it anodyne, and I think the essay itself, and I think that's a really good word. And again, I encourage everyone to go read it. It'll only take about 15 minutes of your time. I would say it's like a very honest portrayal of a woman struggling with what this war means to her as someone who is very obviously not okay with what her government is doing in her name, right, and is taking active measures to help the people that are on the other side of that conflict. It is wild to me that this one caused this much uproar. Jason, I know that you just read it. What did you think?
I don't think you want to know what I think.
I think I do.
No, I'm kidding. No, I mean, honestly, the essay is like exactly what you would expect it to be. You know, I mean, if you were told this is the writer, this is the premise, this would be the essay. I don't think, you know, and it, I don't think there's a problem with that. I have no idea. I mean, I do. I know why people got upset because of the, you know, colonizer, the concept, you know. I mean, so, I mean, if she had been Israeli and written anything other than this is the biggest genocide, you know, since the Armenian one, and the other Holocaust didn't happen, so let's not even talk about that. You know, unless she'd said that, I think she would have been tarred, feathered, and thrown out of Guernica. I mean, it's just, they were waiting. They were waiting in the wings to do this very thing. And it gave them an opportunity for that performative outrage. I mean, I think you said it exactly right, man. I mean, it's exactly right. Anyway, that's my perspective.
Something I've been chewing over too, and so maybe there's a third group of the outraged that deserve mention. I and you two and probably many of the listeners are, you know, we read about this stuff. Like, it's part of kind of our daily diet, right? Like, war language has its own rhythms, it has its own terminology. You know, I do kind of remember some of my like first graduate school MFA workshops, people being a little taken aback by stuff in my work that I thought was very, very basic, just a normal way that soldiers talk to each other. Iraqis talk to soldiers, right? And I thought about that with the blowback here, that because one of the lines that caused a bunch of uproar was the term "good booms."
I've got let me read the graph. Right up here in front of me. I phoned friends to find out how they were doing. Some had sons serving in the army in the South. Others were struggling to keep going. A neighbor told me she was trying to calm her children, who were frightened by the sound of warplanes flying over the house day and night. I tell them these are good booms. She grimaced, and I understood the subtext that the Israeli army was bombing Gaza.
Again, you know, I think that's just kind of very straightforward. Like, it's an interesting line. It's a line that I hear a dark, sad irony in. About a mother trying to comfort her children while also recognizing those booms, you know, could well be killing Palestinian children, right? I hear that in a way that I wonder if you haven't really been exposed to kind of war writing ever, you take it literally, like, you know, but it's hard to tell. I'm trying to be generous with this and say maybe these people are just, they don't hear that irony, they don't hear that sadness, and they're not just kind of using it as a, I don't know, an excuse to rage for the very flat ideological reasons that Jason mentioned.
That is a refrain I heard as I was looking at this repeatedly in the critiques, is that she straight-facedly said that the bombing of Palestine was good, that those were good booms. I know that it has become kind of this refrain recently in culture to say people have poor media literacy, to call them out for that. But I mean, damn, when I see people who read this essay and decide that the action is to shut down the entire magazine that published it, you know, maybe not call for that directly, but that is, I think, effectively what's going to end up happening here, all because of maybe one of the more interesting lines in the entire essay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And to straight-facedly read that as anything other than a dark comment on what's going on. Do these people not want honesty in their literature anymore? I don't know. I struggle with a lot of this.
I don't know. And maybe that answer differs on each person, differs for each person, because, if anyone just wants to be reinforced, to have their comfortable notions reinforced by what they read, we're in a bad place. You said media literacy. The term that came to my mind was like reading comprehension. I mean, this is, my wife's a teacher. Like, she teaches, like, when she taught middle school English, this is the kind of stuff she taught her kids to read. And we have supposed literary magazine readers being able to grasp this. I don't know. I will say a friend who's worked at a similar size magazine tried to get me to, at least be a little less, angry about this or fired up about this yesterday at lunch. He's like, these are volunteers, right? This is kind of small stakes, small potatoes stuff, right? They really have been dragged through the mud now by, you know, National Book Award winner calling them cowards in the Atlantic. Try to give them a little grace. I'm trying, but it is still like on a basic level, like it's
hard when they don't give anyone else grace.
I think that's a great point, because they were dogpiling this one, Joanna Chen was getting no grace, whatsoever, simply for writing from her perspective. I mean, like you both said, this is not an essay saying there are no war crimes happening in Gaza. This was not an essay saying, hey, you voted for Hamas, you deserve what happens. This was not that at all. If they'd published that essay, it probably would have deserved this firestorm. But this essay is not the essay that it's being portrayed to be, for all kinds of reasons.
Jason, when I first told you about this, after our last conversation at like noon, your knee-jerk reaction was that it's anti-Semitism.
Well, I mean, I think that there's a really interesting video that I watched actually partially today. I'd seen it before, explaining, it's by a rabbi named Jonathan Sacks, who is the chief rabbi in the UK, actually. And he's a really, really well thought of theologian. And he explains in this video, and maybe we can put a link to it out there, why attacking Israel in certain ways is anti-Semitism. It's not in all ways. You can say you hate Benjamin Netanyahu. You think it's a terrible government. You can think that, you know, what they're doing is terrible. But the idea, you know, I mean, the argument is that saying that Israel shouldn't exist and that, you know, I mean, has no right to exist, that's where you start getting into anti-Semitism. Why is that the country that can't exist? Why is, you know, I mean, not to get too far into it, I just want to say one thing. I mean, you know, what I've been reading over and over again, there are no third or fourth generation refugees in any other crisis in the world. Palestinians get to be refugees forever. I mean, generation after generation after generation. That's not what a refugee is. But anyway, the world has created this bubble where Israel is a special case. And I mean, I'll admit, what can I say? I'm Jewish. I mean, I do believe that Israel has a right to exist. I think the whole colonization narrative is insane. I mean, forget about inappropriate or anything else. And I do think that some of it is based on, you know, people aren't that fond of Jews, and they still aren't. They weren't. And it's the fact. Anyway, I'm sorry. I don't mean to go on.
What do you mean by third or fourth generation refugees? Are you saying at a certain point you stop calling them refugees? You say that,
well, in every other conflict in the world, yeah. I mean, people get resettled, and I mean, it's just everything's on pause in the Palestinian case, waiting for I don't know what. It's all on pause, and that's unique. I mean, there is no other, I mean, the UN's refugee agency for Palestine is the best funded in the world. It's not the biggest crisis, but it's the best funded. It's not the most acute crisis, except what's happening in Gaza now is incredibly acute, and I don't believe should be happening the way it's happening. I just want to say that. But what's happening in the Congo, you know, I just read about, you know, what's happening there right now. Millions and millions of people have been killed. There are millions of refugees. There are millions of refugees generated in the last year. No one gives a shit. It's a particular conflict that people feel particularly attached to.
Well, I mean, kind of to that point, you know, and Phil mentioned this in his Atlantic article. Guernica recently, I believe it was an interview with Alice Walker. You know, it was a very celebrated American author, but who is, you know, made some very pronounced anti-Semitic remarks over the years. You know, I believe you know, they recommended some kind of real starkly anti-Jewish texts in various interviews, and there was no pushback to that. And there was no pushback to the way there has, you know, sometimes Alice Walker gets disinvited from various galas and events because of these past statements. And there, the Guernica readership, the editorial board had little to nothing to say when her interview ran. So yeah, why this essay? It's certainly not related to her being Israeli and writing from an Israeli's perspective.
Can I read one of your tweets and get you to answer for it?
Let's do it.
Everyone's favorite activity, answering for their posts. there's an anti-veteran strain in American letters and has been for a while. Can't say I know what to do with it, but I appreciate it when it's out in the open like this.
Mm. So it's been interesting. I'm 41. About 10 years ago, 2014, for various political reasons, I suppose, kind of the literary establishment decided to champion us, right? Or at least a small group of us. And I was among that group, and I'm very grateful for it. I mean, we're on the cover of the New York Times. We were in Vanity Fair. It was great. It was cool. And I won't pretend otherwise. It was a great boon to my career. I look back on that now and realize that some powerful people within literary arts, they wanted us or needed us or thought we were kind of maybe more reflexively politically anti-war than most of us were or are, right? We volunteered for military duty. We served in wars that we have deeply conflicted feelings about. But I don't think any of us, at least speak for myself, feel, you know, I love Tim O'Brien. I love his work. But his relationship to Vietnam is very different than mine to Iraq, right? He was a reluctant draftee. It just changes things, right? And I have wondered in the decades since, as that kind of, after that kind of real nice boon and attention has waned, and you know, it's never, nobody ever says anything to you, but it's people who were your best friend suddenly won't answer your emails or pass on an essay about Ukraine because it's arguing the case that we should commit to it, and you realize it isn't necessarily about the work, because the funny thing is I'm a much better writer than I was 10 years ago. It's, you know, the politics have changed, the moment has changed. And I lived, you know, I'm in Tulsa, Oklahoma now, but I lived in New York up until 2021. So I had a front row seat to all this. I remember when Phil won the National Book Award and powerful people were bothered that his speech wasn't anti-war enough. And when I keep using this word anti-war, I don't mean in like a specific case. Like, it wasn't like it had to do with Iraq. It wasn't. Unfortunately, you know, these people are brilliant in many, many things, but like dealing with the complexities of political foreign policy is not one of them. They wanted us to kind of be, and I sound so conspiratorial when I say this stuff, but I'm still, I promise I will name names later. I'm just still young enough in my career. I don't want to be pissing off too many people. But it's just been an interesting change. And especially since the withdrawal from Afghanistan, I have noticed, you know, because in literature, I would say literature is like 90% liberals or lefties, right? Like there are conservative people there, but like they keep their mouth shut for the most part because they just don't want to ostracize themselves. And like, I vote Democrat. So, but I try not to be stupid about it. I have noticed, especially since the withdrawal from Afghanistan, a lot of people, and I don't mean so much other writers, it's so much as like New York editors and New York publishers, they're just kind of settling into kind of like Vietnam era tropes, right? They're kind of like wanting it to be vets to be victims or deeply damaged. I don't know, all the complexity that I hoped we were pouring into our literature 10 years ago, that I hope was the reason people were caring about us and reading. I don't know. It's like it didn't resonate. So I don't know. Maybe there was an answer in your question somewhat to that. I'll admit to being really hypersensitive to this, but I'm not talking out of my neck. Like this has been my lived decade, is what kind of being very hyper attuned to how the literary elite cherished us for their own ends and then are just less interested now.
One thing I would say that's interesting to me, and I think is actually good news, is when you have, and it's only in the last 10 years or so, you have people who are leading New York Times coverage of Ukraine and things like that. They've actually served.
That's true. That's true. On the news side, I think it's great. I mean, TM Gibbons Neff immediately comes to mind.
Exactly who I was thinking.
No, I think it's much healthier on the news side. I worry about kind of the opinion sections, frankly, mm-hmm. and I worry about kind of the literary culture.
Makes total sense to me. I'm not. Yeah, that wasn't the contradiction.
No, but I'm glad you pushed back on that because I don't want to be casting too wide of a net. Because who specifically deserves credit for that, because he did it with a number of people, is Chris Chivers. Chris Chivers, yes. As a veteran himself, kind of used his moment after winning the Pulitzer to hire a bunch of talented vets and also kind of humanitarians who'd spent time in combat zones and place them in important newspapers. And now they're rising because they're proving we're worthy of that.
Yeah. Yeah, we had him on the show once. It was years and years ago, but he was so great, and he was a really, really decent human being too.
I know him just a little bit, but incredible writer, and strikes me as an incredible man as well.
There is this idea, I think, that is resurgent in America, that because it is an all-volunteer force, if you volunteered, you are complicit. Mm-hmm. I think that's part of the anti-vet sentiment you're talking about, right?
Yes, and it's a way for people to maintain some kind of moral purity, some kind of moral authority. People my age, I'll see it. Well, they really want to tell me about the one or two protests they showed up to in 2003, and I was like, well, I'm good for you, and you were right, ultimately right. But you know, how else did you stay engaged, right? We don't all have to be Joanna Chen driving wounded Palestinian children to the hospital to be engaging with this issue. Like, did this impact your vote? Did you do you donate to wounded Iraqi civilian organizations, right? And more often than not, you kind of get blank stares in that regard. It's a deeply unhealthy thing, frankly. So much of the conflict, internal political conflict with America right now, is not just what kind of country do we want to be internally, but also what kind of America do we want to be internationally, right? This is why Ukraine is on the ballot in 2024. There's no doubt about it. And I worry that sentiment, Matthew, that you mentioned of feeling separate, not just separate from the all-volunteer force and not considering us fellow citizens, but above us in some way. is a very harmful thing, and it's going to harm us domestically because you're going to have more and more vets like the ones of January 6th who say, "To hell with it, I'm better than you. I'll show you." And it's going to impact. It's going to have a corrosive effect on us, kind of retreating into old school isolationism, which is, again, from my cheap seat here in the hinterlands of Oklahoma, is just going to make World War III more likely. You know, you'd like to think that we have plenty of historical evidence for that, and people remember this from their high school classes, but I don't know. I'm beginning to wonder if not.
It's cyclical. It's cyclical in the United States, I think. I'm not that surprised that, you know, we're sort of heading towards isolationism at the moment. Not, you know, I mean, and there's so many reasons. I mean, there's the economic stuff where free trade just sort of screwed so many people. You know, just the whole engagement with the world, I think, has made people shy. And then, yeah, and they just don't. They think Vietnam when they see Ukraine, right? I mean, and they just don't see the subtleties, I think.
Right. And I don't think it's a coincidence this is happening as kind of the lived memory of World War II vets are, you know, there's a few left here and there, but they've mostly died out as a generation now. So there's not that kind of personal testimony anymore.
Even Vietnam vets are some of them are elderly.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I mean, all of them are in 60s or older, and it very different place in society for them too.
That's true. No, that's true. And, you know, it's somewhat understandable that they're, you know, did America ever get over fighting about Vietnam? I'm not sure. So maybe it shouldn't be so surprising that's the prism many Americans are trying to view these modern conflicts through.
I also think that there's this thing, just maybe not unique to America, but when you are a part of a nation state and a part of an empire, which I do think we are, although it's a very different shape than previous empires, that you have to reckon with the things that are done in your name as part of that. And mm-hmm. I think that there's an instinct to disavow anything that is associated with the exercise of power. And that if you just push that away and point at it and say that it is bad, and then maybe every few months go out into the streets and say that it is bad, mm-hmm. that buys you at the absolution you need for the things that are done in your name.
I think you're onto something. I mean, even in 2022, before Ukraine became a very hot partisan issue here, there were people that distrusted it simply because, like, the idea that America could be doing something good with our foreign policy again, it seemed like they just instinctively didn't trust it because their anti-Americanism is so deeply ingrained and is so reflexive. And let's face it, we've earned that. I think I'd make the case over the past 15 to 20 years. But to do so reflexively is intellectually lazy, right? Like it's hard, but we have to take these issues at a case by case basis. We have to, otherwise we really are just going to become ideologically stratified to the point that think something does break. Because, you know, if you're at the point where you're not willing to deal with reality, you know, this feels like an Orwell essay, but like, where you're like defying reality because the party tells you it can't be so, you know, we're not a democracy or even attempting to be a democracy anymore. We're, you know, it's really going to break down. And, you know, this whole great American experiment really is going to break down if we can't find a shared objective reality. You know, if 90% of the population can't look at, say, Yemen and say, you know what, keeping the global trade open here is a good thing. And, you know, the Houthis, you know, they keep slaves. They're clear religious radicals. Like, we shouldn't let them shoot on and kill innocent civilian sailors. Like, if we can't get like 90% of Americans on board with that, like we are in more trouble than even I think we are.
That part fucks me up so bad. These are people that keep slaves. We're going to be on their side.
But they're firing around ships with American flags. So they have to be the good guys,
right?
They, you know,
yeah.
Well, I just to say, and I think we're all probably in the same space on this, but on this one day, just to talk about how depressing today has been, I've edited, you know, like 4 op-eds about either anti-Semitism. You see why I'm angry about that today. You know, war, Israel, Gaza, podcast about nuclear war. Now, you know, this. Wow. The world is just a bummer today.
We're a deeply upsetting program. It's true.
Just a bummer. Yeah,
it is. It is. And it kind of makes you maybe understand why some people retreat into easy ideology to find comfort. Mm-hmm. Cause you get fed your talking points that way. Right. Whether you're, you know, a poetry editor at a literary magazine or, you know, whatever. At the same time, like you have, you know, a thinking person just has to push back against that and has to take things on a case by case basis, be at least, you know, willing to state your mind, but also be open to new information and admit you're wrong. I don't know, to bring it back to this small literary journal. I would love to see one of these editors that resign and say, you know what? I got ahead of myself. The essay was, I don't agree with the essay. It makes me angry for X, Y, or Z reasons, but it deserves its place. It deserves to be read. And rather than quitting, rather than trying to cancel it, here's my response. Cause I'm a writer and I'm a serious person and I want to continue the conversation. Like that, I would have so much respect for the person that does something like that. But right now, it's just a hypothetical. Maybe I'm wish casting it into the world.
The shutting down of conversation and the immediate anger when you ask for an explanation about why the conversation is being shut down is very, I will say, dangerous. I will go ahead and say dangerous.
Yeah. It's a control. I mean, it does feel like kind of like the old, and I don't use this term like in kind of contemporary American politics, but like kind of like the old liberal order, like people are, is under assault. And part of the old liberal order is free speech, is being willing to hear out people you disagree with. Then trusting that you have the space to respond, not violently, not in a way that, you know, whatever the current buzzword, deplatforms them, or, you know, whatever the current buzzword is. You know, you have to wrestle with these things. This kind of reminded me, like a bigger version of this was like the Tom Cotton op-ed a few years ago.
Oh yeah. Which the Atlantic piece by the editor who had published it.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Exactly.
You saw that? You saw
that? I did see that. Yeah. Yeah. And yeah. The snapping, but like even that, like there was a disagreement of whether that anecdote even occurred. Right.
There was another version of this recently where I think it was in the Atlantic, the gentleman who was kind of the conservative opinion editor at the New York Times said he got in trouble for saying that he liked Chick-fil-A during an
onboarding. Yeah, that's it. That's where the snapping was.
Oh, that's where the snapping thing was. Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, okay. For, yeah, yeah,
for
yeah.
Being, yeah, so, him being called out about having a, you know, anti-LGBTQ sandwich.
Kind of the knee-jerk reaction was that this anecdote didn't happen. One of the Washington Post media reporters actually chased it down and confirmed that it had.
Yeah.
But no one ever talks about that part of it.
No. Well, yeah, because the culture war conversation had moved on to something else at that point. But I mean, you had very, very prominent journalists. Like, I think Nicole Hannah-Jones said, no way this happened. You know, there's another debate of like, is this, she just being a person on Twitter expressing her opinion, or is she a New York Times journalist? You know, I don't work in the newspaper world to say definitively there, but like that was fascinating to me. And the facts, all I know about this whole thing is Tom Cotton, if they just let that op-ed run, Tom Cotton would have gotten all kinds of deserved, in my opinion, political pushback for calling for invoking the Insurrection Act in the New York Times. And, you know, sitting senator saying that, I think, deserves prominent attention, and it deserves all kinds of heated pushback.
It's a bad take, to be clear.
It's a terrible take. And it would have been in and out of the news cycle within a week, right? But here we are still talking about it 4 years later because of the pushback, because the fierce resistance to even running it. I mean, you know, it cost both the opinion editor and the deputy opinion editor their jobs. It cost that junior editor his job. And
it was approved.
It's become a bigger thing because of it.
Yeah, absolutely. But it was also, he followed procedure.
That's right.
He followed procedure. He got fired anyway because they wanted to, you know, sacrifice somebody.
It wasn't as if he knew he was publishing something absolutely wild, right? It's not as if he didn't know that.
Right.
But also that's part of what the opinion page is for.
Right.
Yeah, you don't have to agree with it. But I mean, again, if it was some junior editor who just threw things out there, you know, fine, fired him. This is a guy who went through the process. They have like 12 layers of people, and he still got that, you know, somehow the low man on the totem pole got fired. Shocking. Shocking.
Anyway. Yeah. Well, but he did deserve it because he admitted that he likes Chick-fil-A. So,
yeah, absolutely.
I'm revealing maybe another side of my both side self here, that, you know, especially here in Oklahoma, Chick-fil-A is very big and I like it. It makes good chicken, but I never want it more ever than Sunday after church, because there's some basic primal human like desire being expressed of like, we always want what we can't have. Mm-hmm. And that is coming out. And it's happened enough now that I know it's not just a one-off. It happens like 3 out of 4 Sundays every month here. All I want is a chicken sandwich from Chick-fil-A and I cannot have it.
Yeah. Not on Sunday. It's the Lord's Day. It's not Chicken's Day.
So I'm angry at both sides of this for keeping my Chick-fil-A sandwich away from me on Sunday.
Not to completely go off onto a tangent, but I also do think that's
really?
Yeah, sorry.
Really? Now you're worried about the tangent?
Yeah, at the very
now
end.
Now you're worried?
Just that I think that there is also a sickness in American culture that we have to process all of our political opinions through our consumer choices. It's also perhaps a bad instinct in general, but that's a whole other podcast.
Where does it end though? I mean, at one point we have liberal pillows and conservative pillows now. It could impact every part of American life if we really follow this thing through.
It sucks.
We're going to have to make sacrifices.
There's money in it. That's the problem.
Right.
Well, and whatever you buy, you're supporting slavery if you look far enough up the chain, unfortunately. I mean, so what do you know, you're not going to eat, you're not going to go out, you're not going to...
Again, you're having to reckon with your place in this vast American empire, and it's hard to do. So you pick something like Chick-fil-A, and you push back against that specifically.
Mm-hmm.
We are all compromised, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
That's one takeaway, yeah.
Anyway, Matthew, read Orwell.
Do you have anything worse to say? Do you have anything even darker?
Should we return to Ukraine? Should we return to the subject of Ukraine?
No, I want to end on this note. You said you encouraged people all in one of your, again, making you answer for your tweets. You encouraged people to read Orwell outside of 1984.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's good. There's a lot of wonderful stuff there. Read Homage to Catalonia. Read, Can the Socialist Be Happy? Read Politics in the English Language, all these things, and come away with someone that maybe has similar politics to you, but I think had a pretty clear-eyed vision of the 20th century and its evils and what was worth fighting for.
Yeah, and what's interesting about Orwell is like there's different versions of him,
mm-hmm.
and you know people. I think, and I've been guilty of this myself. We all kind of glom onto the one version we most identify with. Elon Musk, for example, is very, very high on pretending to quote the 1984 version. but certainly isn't familiar with the anti-wealth version of anti-imperial version of Orwell. Otherwise, I don't think Mr. Musk would be quoting him so much. you know, the hardcore anti-war protesters, right? You know, love Burmese Days, his early work, and it's rightfully so. He that's the experience that kind of shaped him. But you know, then when he gets to Spain, he is not reflexively anti-war. He determines that fight against fascism to be a just cause, to not be the same thing as what he saw in Burma as an imperial policeman for the British Empire. I think I just, you know, I recently reread his essay Looking Back on the Spanish Civil War, which he wrote after Homage to Catalonia, and so in the midst of World War II, so he has a bit more distance, and I was just really struck with kind of those sharp political insights and the kind of unbridled rage he had toward Western intelligentsia for not seeing what was coming with World War II. And you know, having a writer that good, that angry at those people, I don't know. I if you haven't read it, I recommend it. If any of that rings true to your ears, because it was fun. I hadn't read it in years. It was great.
What's the title of it?
Looking Back on the Spanish Civil War, and I think it's online for free at the Orwell Foundation. It should be probably the very top thing that pops up on a Google search.
Matt Gallagher, where can people find Daybreak?
Daybreak is available wherever books are sold. It's on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, your local independent bookstore, which I'd encourage you to order through if you support your local indie. You can also just find me on mattgallagherwriter.com. Send me a tweet. Hit me up on Instagram. I usually get, unless you're crazy, I'll get back to you.
Thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, and Guernica's, I think, going to be publishing excerpts. Is that right?
Yeah. Well, if they come back, we'll see. But would love that. Enjoy the conversation, guys. Thank you.
Thank you.
In Guernica, the dead children were laid out in order upon the sidewalk, in their white starched dresses, in their pitiful white dresses. On their foreheads and breasts are the little holes where death came in as thunder while they were playing their important summer games. Do not weep for them, Madre. They're gone forever, the little ones, straight to heaven, to the saints, and God will fill the bullet holes with candy.